It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
If you were walking on the streets of Milwaukee in the early 1980s, you might have seen this trio playing a set on the corner, in part because they couldn't get gigs at music venues.
But within a few years, the Violent Femmes had an album out opening with that song, Blister in the Sun, and over the years, it went gold and then platinum.
Now, if you search online for the most famous band from Milwaukee, that quirky street corner folk punk trio is the top answer.
The Violent Femmes and their self-titled debut album are the subject of the latest book in the long-running music book series called 33 and a Third.
Nick Brown is a writer, musician, and English professor at Clemson University. His new book is simply called Violent Femmes. Nick, welcome to the show.
I am super excited to be here. Thanks.
A big part of the story you tell in your book about the Violent Femmes and their first album is that they kind of defy categorization in a lot of ways. For people who haven't been introduced to the Violent Femmes somehow at this point, how do you try to describe their music to them?
Well, you know, at one point in the book, I described that they occupy this overlapping realm of folk, punk, and jazz, which I call a Bermuda Triangle for anybody. But they pull it off, for the most part, because their songs are so great. Gordon Gano, the primary singer-songwriter, he had this incredible collection of songs when the band formed. And they're so well put together that they could have worked in any setting, really. But the Violent Femmes themselves had one of the most unique arrangements of instruments possible. And that's the biggest surprise for people when they, mostly when they see the Femmes. A lot of what's most unusual about them is often invisible on a recording. But they're a one-of-a-kind band, and their debut record is a one-of-a-kind record. It didn't sound like anything else then, and it still doesn't sound like anything else today.
We'll dig into that unique instrumentation in a bit. But in 2015, I talked to bassist Brian Ritchie here on WPR about why their unique sound made life difficult for them. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
Well, we were on the sidewalks because the clubs didn't want anything to do with us. They didn't even think that we were not even related to rock music.
And so you write, their early days, they were literally playing on the streets. Tell us a little bit about the Violent Femmes and their early public performances.
You know, as Brian mentioned, they had a hard time getting gigs. They busked, and they had instrumentation that made it easy for them to do this. And this is by design, too. So Victor DiLorenzo, the drummer, played standing up with brushes with just a snare drum and then what he calls a transophone, which is a metal bushel basket placed on top of another drum. Gordon would play guitar on the street, usually, you know, an acoustic guitar. And then Brian Ritchie would play an acoustic bass guitar, which to most people sounds like stand-up bass, like what you'd see in a jazz trio. But it looked more like a mariachi-style bass. And Brian's point was, you know, he couldn't haul a stand-up bass around. He didn't even have a driver's license. He couldn't drive it around. So they had instruments that were made to play on the street. And the fact that they spent so much time playing on the street, I think, is part of the reason the band works so well. There are few performance spaces less forgiving than a street corner in Milwaukee, right? Or anywhere. And they honed this act on the street corners so that they could make their songs work in that setting. And because of that, when they finally got into the studio to record their debut album, they were a really well-oiled machine, despite the fact they hadn't spent much time on actual stages.
And they had to be, right? You write that they got a $10,000 loan from somebody's dad, Victor's dad, I think, to get into the studio. That doesn't buy you a lot of studio time. That street discipline made them pretty good recording artists, weirdly enough.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, remember, this was recorded in 1982. Nobody had the recording options that we have now. So, yeah, Victor, the drummer, was tasked with finding funds to do this recording. He was the oldest and sort of the most put together and had the most professional experience, and he struck out everywhere. So he eventually got $10,000 from his dad, They went into the studio for a week and essentially recorded the tracks live. There was no time for experimentation or, you know, trying things out. They tracked mostly live with a few overdubs. You know, because of that, the approach that Mark Van Hecke, the producer, took in the studio was to recreate Elvis's Son sessions. And so the recording doesn't have a production style stamp that dates it. There's no gated snare. There's no delay on the guitars. So it sounds like it could have been recorded in 1951, in 1982, in 1996. It sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday. And that timeless aspect of the actual recording that they made in the studio is part of what's allowed this record to live on, because it's timeless in its production and its songwriting in so many ways. So I don't know if they knew that that's what they were doing, but it worked.
Well, and the way to make a successful album in the 1980s was to do all the stuff you just said. Layer on synthesizers, really processed drums, right? Lots of things like that. They didn't do it. And that, when they went to look for a label, that wasn't an easy sell. What was that like, trying to find somebody to actually, you know, press this vinyl and get it out on the market?
It was failure after failure, really. They tried to get a record deal before they went into the studio. They had one very small label, a good one out of New York, that was interested. That fell through, and so that's why they eventually recorded it themselves. They had a lot of pressure from some people who did recognize a spark there to do that 80s rock and roll production that you mentioned, with the more processed sound, the synthesizers. And, you know, they had a surprising amount of confidence at the age that they were at to stick with their sound. So eventually there was a label called Slash Records, a small punk label in California, and they turned the band down. Two employees at Slash loved this recording so much that they kept playing the cassette in the offices at Slash until the owner finally said, okay, you know, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to sign this man, not because I want to, but because I'm so sick of hearing my employees playing it every day. So that's how they ended up getting their record deal with Slash Records. And they say it's the worst record deal, you know, any band could ever have signed, but they did what they had to, and the record came out, and the rest is history.
Right. If I were writing the movie, I would say, okay, then the record came out, and it was a smash hit right away. But hang on. It took 4 years to go gold, another 4 years to go platinum. I remember discovering it, or it being discovered and handed to me in the 80s on a copied cassette. Yep. How did this thing go viral in, you know, that pre-internet era?
Yeah. So I describe it as going viral over 8 years via cassette. Part of it is what you described exactly, which is young people connecting with the songs and sharing dubbed cassette tapes. So right now, they say this album has sold 7 million copies. And I say, you need to ask Maxwell how many blank tapes they sold between 1983 and 1991 and just, you know, add in about 30% of that, because a lot of people don't know what the album cover looks like. I had a guy at a reading recently tell me, that isn't the album cover that I'm looking at. He was looking at the record. He said, the album cover is whatever guy's handwriting wrote Violent Femmes on my blank tape. And so it was a real organic word of mouth build over 8 years. But when the record came out, there was not a lot of interest in the States. They went to Europe, and when they came back, there were a couple college radio stations that started playing it quite a bit. And that's where the first spark in the U.S. sort of started. It was in college radio. And then it just kept spreading and still is.
We're talking about the Milwaukee band Violent Femmes. Our guest is writer Nick Brown, author of a new book on the band's self-titled debut album and rise to fame. I want to dig into the song, the sound you were talking about just a little while ago, Nick. And I want to start with bassist Brian Ritchie, who plays what you describe in the book, as you mentioned, acoustic bass, not upright bass, but acoustic bass. And he plays it, you say, like a lead bass. Here's a taste of how that sounds on the track, Do Not Go.
Thank you.
And Nick, you write, this is kind of wrong. This is unusual for bands to have that bass being the melodic lead. Talk a little more about how they approached that.
The band was a trio. Gordon, the singer, songwriter, played guitar, and he plays rhythm guitar well, but that was about the extent of his real technical prowess. And with Victor, the drummer's stripped-down approach of just playing brushes on a snare drum, essentially, it left all this sonic landscape open that Brian Ritchie could fill. Now, you know, my friend Shannon always describes this record as being all lead bass. And we laugh about it. And I asked, you know, Brian, is that really the case? And he basically said, yeah, this is probably the most bass-forward recording in popular music history. But the reason is he had that space to work with. And also, Brian Ritchie is an incredible musician. And so this thing happens on these songs where the melodic statements that aren't happening with Gordon's vocal are usually made on the bass guitar. And then as we hear on Please Do Not Go and a few other songs, I mean, Brian Ritchie takes bass solos, and I mean long bass solos, unaccompanied by any other instrument. And they sound so natural and great that you actually don't even think they're bass solos. I mean, as I think we all know, often there's a bass solo happening, that's when we might skip the song, I'm sorry to say. And that doesn't apply to most of Brian Ritchie's work or any of it. Yeah, he's the lead bassist here.
You mentioned the unique drum setup for Victor DiLorenzo, the metal bushel basket. No kick drum. Here's a little taste of the drumming now during the guitar solo on Add It Up. Now, Nick, you're a drummer yourself. What are we hearing in his playing, not just on that track, but in general, that makes it hard in some cases for other drummers to wrap their head around when they're sitting at their full kit?
Well, first of all, he is playing with no kick drum. Mm-hmm.
And for non-musicians, that's the like doop, doop, doop sound you hear in rock song, the kick drum.
That's right. And that usually fills up the one and the three in a measure. So we get, you know, and that's the traditional rhythm that we're used to hearing. When you listen to this record, a lot of that rhythm is still there, even though Victor isn't playing the kick drum, because Brian Ritchie is playing, he's recreating a lot of those bass drum parts with his bass guitar. And so between Victor and Brian, the rhythm section sort of becomes a functional drum set where the bass drum is also playing a melody. But especially because of the prevalence of cassette tapes at the time that this record gained popularity, this very minimal arrangement on the recording allowed it to sound incredible on cassette. It's very minimal sonic information, and what that does is it allows Gordon's voice and his vocals to really rise to the surface, and he has incredibly compelling and vulnerable lyrics on this album, and that really helped deliver the message of this record to those of us who were soaking it up.
Now, you're a music fan, you're a musician yourself, you're a writer. You admit in the book, enjoying the album and the music. What drew you so enthusiastically into this project?
Two things. One, the book series that it's a part of, 33 and a Third, is just a classic series that guys like me were always dreaming about. Oh, what record would I want to pitch for 33 and a Third? So this album had always been in my head as that record. And then I published a memoir about 3 years ago about my career as a musician. And in it, I mentioned how important this album was. And one of the members of the Femmes management read that memoir and actually reached out to me about maybe doing a project with them at some point. So this sort of simmering dream of mine to pitch a 33 and a Third book rose to the surface. And I thought, I'm going to go for it. So it was sort of a double dream for me to have a book in the series and to be able to write it with the participation of all three members and the producer. So it was, you know, it's sort of a dream's come true, a fan's dream come true.
Yeah. Now, Nick, one time I got to interview jazz legend Herbie Hancock, and I'll say that's the one time I almost lost my power of speech, blown away to be talking to this particular person. Did you have a moment? Because you, as you mentioned, you talked to all three original members. Did you have that kind of I'm not worthy moment at all?
You know, luckily for me, since I'm a musician, I had like a technical entry point that leveled the playing field a little bit. I definitely couldn't believe I was on the phone with Gordon Gano for hours, you know, at a time. But for me, if I was finding ways to talk about the structure of a song or arrangement or recording process, it sort of became a little bit more of a technical exercise, which I think helped. But still, going to see them backstage after a show, having them, you know, share stories was the, you know, 11-year-old Nick Brown who discovered this record in 1988 would never have believed it.
Nick, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nick Brown is a writer, musician, and English professor at Clemson University. He's with us today to share his new book, Violent Femmes, about the Milwaukee alternate rock band, its self-titled debut album, and its rise to fame.
Coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers held some early morning games during World War II so that factory workers on the night shift could catch a game. A new children's book honors that history.
They had the team's manager wearing pajamas, and they carted him out on a four-post bed onto the field and then, you know, woke him up. It was like a little skit.
The author of Baseball for Breakfast is next on WPR News. You're with us on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The Milwaukee Brewers are off to a great start, leading the National League Central Division. Baseball has had a long, special place in Milwaukee.
But during World War II, many people couldn't attend the games because they worked the overnight shift as the city converted its factories to make weapons and machinery for the war effort.
At that time, the Milwaukee Brewers were a minor league baseball team, and they came up with a solution, baseball for breakfast. Morning games were a way for the city's second and third shift workers to still go to the ballpark.
And Baseball for Breakfast is the subject and title of a new illustrated children's book. Maggie Carroll is the book's illustrator. She's based in the village of Heartland near Milwaukee. Maggie, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And Judy Campbell-Smith is the book's author. Judy, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Judy, you don't live in Milwaukee, but I understand that you're a big baseball fan. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Yeah, I don't live in Milwaukee, but I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and that's kind of how I came to this story. I was reading about the history of the White Sox, which is my team, and Bill Veeck was once the owner of the White Sox and also at another time of the Milwaukee Brewers. And I just read this line in his bio about morning baseball games during World War II, and it really sparked something in my imagination. So that kind of led me to look into more about this story.
Yeah, the team's owner, Bill Veeck, at the time, he was such a promoter of baseball. What ideas did he come up with to make baseball fun and more accessible for fans at Borchardt Field?
Yeah, he would try anything. So he was doing giveaways, but he would, not like today, he would give away like giant blocks of ice or live livestock and living animals. And he would have like live music, which we don't really see that much anymore at baseball. So he was a real showman and just tried to do anything to make it fun and exciting for fans.
What were you able to learn about how the team started playing baseball in the morning?
It was great to find some historical records of that and some stories from people who were there. And so they did the games in the morning, and they we know that they served breakfast foods. So they served cereal and coffee and donuts. In not every game, but at least one game, which is what I feature in the book, they had the team's manager wearing pajamas, and they kind of carted him out on a four-post bed onto the field and then, you know, woke him up. It was like a little skit. So it was just a really unique thing to have baseball going on in the morning, but then they really leaned into the theme.
I just love that moment in the book because it is so corny, and yet, you know, it is historical as well.
Yeah, I love the quirkiness of it, that it is just this thing that could only have happened maybe in the space and time, but it just brings out all the fun.
Maggie, you're from Wisconsin. What was it like to illustrate a book about your home state?
Yeah, it was a really fun opportunity because I was able to do a lot of research and learn more about my state and see like historical photos, which is really exciting for me.
What was it like for you to, illustrate this book? What did you use? What did you draw on?
For the illustrations, I did a lot of research. One of the illustrators I looked at was Eric Revillius, who's a British wartime artist. So incorporating that historical inspiration was really fun. And I looked a lot at his use of line work over color and how he uses a lot of framing. So that was a really exciting influence to integrate.
Can you describe your favorite illustration of the book, if you have one?
Ooh, yeah, I really liked, well, a lot of them were a lot of fun to draw because I got to draw a lot of people and exciting scenes. But I think my favorite one was the scene showing Pop going to war and Ma dressed up for like the factory. So I just like drawing like all the different scenes on that spread and emphasizing like everyone working hard during that time.
Mm. Judy, what made you think, you know what, this would make a great children's book?
I think that's just how my mind works. I'm always kind of looking for little bits of history that I can turn into stories for kids. That's kind of my favorite genre. And with this story, when I came across it, I was like, okay, there's baseball, which I love. So I'd been wanting to write something about baseball. It had World War II, which I felt was just an interesting time of history, but it also had this very fun aspect to it. So it wasn't like a sad war story. It actually is very joyful. And so all those things were just, to me, felt like there was a possibility to make a book for kids that was set in this time period, but also about baseball, but still fun. So I think it came together, but it is, yeah, kind of a strange way to go about it for kids.
And we get a glimpse of this family who loved baseball as well. This is minor league Brewers of the 1940s. And you created a fictional Black family around this team. And you created, you know, the father is fighting in the war. The mother is working nights in a factory. The son is missing these family outings to games and all the things they did together when they went to these games. What are you exploring through this family lens?
Yeah, I think it is a family story. It makes something that was happening to all kinds of families, not just white families, but Black families all over the country where this was happening. Parents were going off to war. Parents were switching up hours and things like that. And for me, when I was growing up, all the World War II stories were about white families and white soldiers. And that is definitely a huge part of our history. But I was proud to be able to show a Black family because this was also a reality for Black families and brown families during the war. And I was inspired by my grandpa who did serve in World War II as an electrician. And so to me, it just felt like a way to put my family history into the book, even though it is a fictional family. It does represent my family, but a lot of families.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, your grandfather, Roger Smith, and then in this book, Pop joins the Navy. I feel like it is, in a way, a bit of a tribute. Do you think?
It really is. And that when I was coming up with what was going to happen to the fictional family, it just, when I realized like, oh, I can make him go off to war like my grandpa and serve in the Navy, it just felt like a very special way to pay a small tribute to him. And then even just to get to mention his name in the back matter, I feel like that's something that is just going to be really special to my family for years going forward.
We sometimes have the image of, like, for women, of Rosie the Riveter with her sleeves and her muscle, but she is white. And so you also have this Black woman going off to these overnight shifts in the factory.
Yeah, I would like to say I love the way Maggie illustrated all of that. She did such a wonderful job. But I just love to see
A Black woman represented kind of as that Rosie the Riveter figure. The Rosie the Riveter image is so iconic and inspiring, but again, it just captures one part of the reality. And so there are, you know, there were Black women, brown women, you know, all types of people who were serving in this war effort. So it was great to just show that representation for kids, that this really was something that everyone was impacted by, and a lot of people were sacrificing in different ways to serve through this time period.
We're learning about the new children's book. It's called Baseball for Breakfast, about how the Milwaukee Brewers played some morning baseball games during World War II. Judy Campbell-Smith is the book's author. Maggie Carroll is the illustrator. Maggie, did you learn anything about Wisconsin in working on this book?
Yeah, I learned a lot. Just seeing like pictures from that time period was completely new to me, because I've seen pictures from like other like states and stuff, but seeing more like specific to Wisconsin was really exciting, as well as like learning about like the Brewers, because I didn't have any knowledge about that time period for them. So that was a very interesting for me.
What do you like about illustrating for children's books, Maggie?
I really like to draw exciting things, or like try to come up with like fresh things for children's books. I really like incorporating research, but trying to make it like fun and exciting for kids.
Judy, how much do you collaborate on the direction of Maggie's art, or did you trust her to just run with her ideas? How does that work?
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny that you asked that, because this is the first time Maggie and I are talking together in children's books. Quite often, the author hands over their written work to the art director and the illustrator, who kind of work separately. So we really didn't collaborate directly. I did send her some notes and research that I had, some photos that I thought would be helpful. But I think it's amazing, because one reason why I loved her work, it just felt right for the time period. But I feel like somehow there's that cosmic connection where Maggie just really found exactly the heart of the story and the right tone and colors for it. So there's certain pages that I when I saw them, I'm like, that's exactly what I wanted, even though I hadn't told her what I wanted. But I think that's just a really wonderful talent that illustrators have, but especially Maggie in this book just really made it just, I'm so happy with what she did. It was just, yeah, really a big gift and privilege to have her illustrate my story.
I wonder what jumped out when you know, what did you think the first time you saw her illustrations and saw them next to your words?
Oh, it's just an exciting moment for an author when you get those first sketches and you start to see it. When I saw her work before she started working, the publisher sent me like samples of her previous work, and I just felt it had the right energy to it. I'm not an artist, but just it felt right. It looked a little retro, but also still fresh. And so when I saw the pictures that she had done for the book, I was just like, yes, I had the right instinct about her. She just was perfect for it. And seeing the colors that she chose for things and just seeing the characters come to life, it's just so exciting. And it just feels like, yeah, that I couldn't have picked a better partner for this.
Judy, is it hard to come up with ideas for children's books? Do you get the feeling of it's been done before, or do they flow pretty freely for you in terms of ideas?
I think for me, ideas are really easy. They come all the time. A lot of them are bad. a lot of them have been done. Or when I actually write them, it's like very boring. But I get ideas all the time. And I'm just trying to land on the ideas that are going to turn into a really unique and compelling story. So I feel like I'm always getting ideas from everything that I see, and inspired by things in history, but things my kids are doing. Everything is inspiring to me, but it's the creative process of kind of searching through all those ideas to figure out which are really worth pursuing is a fun part of the process to me.
What is a good writing day for you?
It really varies. I have another job and I have kids who are now home for the summer. So a lot of writing days are actually writing nights for me. That's maybe when I can write. But a good day would be if I can get a few hours, maybe when the kids are at an activity or at school, and I can just focus on the story or focus on research and feel like I'm making progress on something. But I don't necessarily have like a writer's schedule right now that's always the same or consistent. It's kind of mom life a lot of the times, but still being able to get those moments and work in those hours is always nice.
Maggie, what does a good drawing day look like for you?
I try to draw every day, but I usually try to draw like all day, but then there are like stuff like emailing or other types of like market prep to do. But yeah, if I finish one drawing in a day, then I'm happy.
Do you find yourself sometimes starting over with drawings, or how do you know when you've got it right, that you've hit it?
Yeah, sometimes it's like frustrating when a drawing doesn't work out, because I really want it to work, but then when I realize no matter how hard I keep trying, it won't work, then I have to restart. And then, yeah, there's like a certain feeling, or I feel like building on that drawing, like, oh, it's going somewhere. So, yeah, that's how I know.
Well, Judy and Maggie, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much. It's been really fun to talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was an exciting opportunity.
That is author Judy Campbell-Smith and illustrator Maggie Carroll. The book is called Baseball for Breakfast, a mostly true story. It's based on historical events when the Milwaukee Brewers hosted morning games during World War II, so people working overnight shifts in factories could still enjoy the games. Judy has a book event and reading set for June 27th at Wauwatosa Public Library. It's at 11 a.m.
Coming up, the Lake Pepin 3-speed bike tour is like going back in time to a bygone era with tweed jackets and breeches.
We get a group of roughly 100 people that we lovingly refer to as nutters to get on bikes that are relatively old.
Meet a group that embraces the golden era of English cycling. That's next on WPR News. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Wisconsin Weekend.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic building in eastern Wisconsin.
On the western coast of Lake Michigan sits the city of Manitowoc, a place known for its deep connection with the water. And along its shore, a lighthouse, essential to the area's maritime history, stands tall, watching over the city. Molly Hunkin climbed inside to take us on a tour.
Okay, well, welcome to Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. You're about half a mile out in the lake here. Ludington is about 60 miles across the lake, straight over here. So you're out in the center of things here.
Paul Reckel is a member of Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary, a locally based group which organizes fundraising events for the community. Within the past decade, they have also become the official caretakers of the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. The lighthouse was built in 1918, making it over 100 years old. Its name comes from the structure that it's built on.
When you walked out here on the concrete, that's the breakwater. And basically what that is, it separates the lake from the harbor, and it makes a safe place for the ships to come in and be protected.
The building itself has 5 stories. Its first floor is a basement, which used to act as storage and a boathouse. In this portion of the basement was a dory, a small boat which lighthouse keepers used for rescues.
But you can read stories on it where the lighthouse keepers in its day would take care of the rescues out on the lake when they occurred. And even in the middle of winter, a tremendous blizzard, at night, no lights. They had to listen to the sounds and actually push the boat out, hop in it, and go out and rescue the people and then bring it back in.
On the second floor, the motor room housed the motor to generate power for the light on top. Above that sits the watch room, where lighthouse keepers used radio equipment to keep in touch with boats out on the lake. In cases of stormy weather, sometimes lighthouse keepers stayed overnight in cots in this room, though they normally slept on shore. The diaphone room on the fourth floor used to be the location of the foghorn, also called a diaphone. Ships could activate the diaphone from the lake to warn of their arrival on shore. From the deck outside, you can see the Badger Car Ferry, which has been running since the 1950s, beginning its round trip between Manitowoc and Ludington, Michigan.
Two toots like that, that's a salute to us. Thank you.
After a brief climb up a small metal ladder, you reach what most people would think of when imagining a lighthouse, the lens house.
That's where the light that signals to the ships is located. And this particular light could be seen from 17 miles out in the lake, which is by no means...
The small room on top of the lighthouse holds no more than the light itself, with enough space for a few people around it. The expansive view looks out over Lake Michigan and the city of Manitowoc. After the need for lighthouse keepers disappeared, the building became run down. It succumbed to vandalism and the wear and tear expected for a building in the middle of a lake. But in 2011, the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse was put on auction by the Coast Guard. It was purchased by a man from Long Island, New York, named Philip Carlucci, for $30,000.
You buy property from the Coast Guard, you have to bring it up to standards and maintain it. So he stuck over $325,000 into it to get it in the condition it is in today.
The owner and Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary are collaborating with the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, also located in Manitowoc, to return historical objects and equipment to the building. Looking forward, the owner hopes to continue restoring the lighthouse to its original state.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on the Manitowoc Breakwater Lighthouse. The building itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is a warm spring day at a park on a river surrounded by lush green hills, dozens of men and women sporting an assortment of tweed jackets, wool suits, dresses, and breeches mingle together. They're admiring one another's shiny three-speed bicycles.
No, that's not a postcard from the pre-war English countryside. It's the start of the 2026 Lake Pepin three-speed bike tour along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border.
It's a way for cyclists to explore the food, drink, and scenery along the Mississippi River while getting in touch with old friends and an old way of life.
Producer Beatrice Lawrence went to the start of the ride in Red Wing. She started by talking with ride organizer Noah Holzer from Burnsville, Minnesota.
We have been doing this for 24 years as of this year, and we get a group of roughly 100 people that we lovingly refer to as nutters because we're a little nuts.
That's right, they're nuts. Because Noah Holzer and his group have come out on an 80-degree spring day, dressed in tweed suits and knee-high socks, to ride the hills of the Driftless area on antique three-speed bicycles. The bikes are comfortable, but heavy. In the words of one rider I spoke to, it's like pedaling a Cadillac.
The oldest that we'll have here is probably going to be mid-40s, and the newest is probably going to be early 80s. All of these bikes are of mostly British manufacture, and all of them are equipped with three-speed internally geared hubs, which allow them to, well, have three gears and shift a lot differently than modern bikes that we're used to.
They're decked out with picnic baskets and old saddlebags pinned with Union Jack flags and souvenir tags from previous year's rides. Plus, they've got holders for flasks and tobacco pipes and vintage bells. The only rules for this ride, no Lycra, no derailers.
One of my friends said, this is cosplay for cyclists, is what this is.
That's Mike Beatty, who hauls his bike up from San Antonio, Texas every year for the Lake Pepin 3-Speed Tour.
Yeah, I've always thought that that was a great statement about what we're involved in.
The idea from the ride came from Noel Robinson, who lived on both sides of the Minnesota and Wisconsin border. He created the tour with his friend, John Sherritt.
My name is John Sherritt. I am the previous Shirt Tail organizer, so my title is Shirt Tail Organizer Emeritus. So he invited us to come down and ride around Lake Pepin. Well, we thought he was nuts. You know, we're not going to ride 3-speeds around Lake Pepin, but after a beer or two, it made perfect sense.
In 2022, Robinson passed away in his sleep while camping on another bike tour at the age of 85. And he still looms large on this ride. His image is on pins and bumper stickers. There's even a cardboard cutout of him standing in the corner of the parking lot where we're gathered. And the ride itself has stayed close to his original vision.
This is cycling as it used to be, and it's cycling as it should be in the future. So you're actually doing a little bit of time travel. Old bike with old friends, riding an old route. And, you know, we stop at old restaurants and look over overlooks and scenic vistas that are, how do we describe that? They've been around since time began.
Before they leave, the riders gather for the blessing of the bicycles, delivered by John Hansen, dressed in a stole and a clerical collar.
Believe me, these bikes need blessing. That might be the only thing that gets them by.
Amen.
Dearly beloved, I humbly pray and beseech you, as many as are here present, to accompany me with a glorious thirst and some ready cash unto the taverns of Wisconsin, and grant further that we may hereafter lead a goodly, riotous, and inebriate life to the glory of thy most perfect ride.
Hear, hear, hear.
Remember, Lord, that many of our bicycles have risen from the dead, much like yourself. Bless these, our bikes.
And cue the bicycle-themed hymn.
Bring me my steed of knotting and steel. Bring me my steed of burning fire. Here is my palm, please bend my wheel. Bring me the drink of my desire. I will not cease to sing the praise.
In the name of the Holy Trinity, high gear, direct drive, and low, go forth and ride.
Ride!
Off we go.
With that, riders hop on their blessed bikes and hit Wisconsin Highway 35, also known as the Great River Road. Here's organizer Noah Holzer.
We are going approximately 85 miles by the shortest route. If we take any of the other optional side routes, which we have highlighted for our riders as well, it could be up to 100 miles. And we are going across Lake Pepin into Wisconsin, down the Wisconsin side from Red Wing to Wabasha, staying overnight there, and then going back tomorrow from Wabasha to Red Wing by the Minnesota side.
Marla Schmidt has been coming back for 20 years. She likes the pace.
You don't have to go fast. You can stop as much as you want with no shame. So it's very, very leisure. You get to stop and eat and drink a lot, like every 7 miles, because there's a town and a train stop. So it's also the people that you meet every year. It's kind of like camp. Come back to see your camp friends because they're from other places.
Some favorite Wisconsin pit stops are the Smiling Pelican Bake Shop in Maiden Rock, Stockholm Pie Company, Nelson Creamery, and the iconic Bay City Hill.
The Bay City Hill. No.
Liar.
That's the worst part. Yeah, the Bay City Hill is the most brutal part of this ride.
Riders face the hill near the beginning of their journey, and it's 2.5 miles of constant uphill riding. Here's what they have to say to me at the halfway point.
Good morning.
Good morning. How's the climb?
Oh, it's fine. Just take it slow and easily.
Are you almost there?
Halfway there.
Slow but steady.
I'm not even breathing hard.
Almost there.
With a 50-pound bike, heavy wool clothing, and often a belly full of beer, it is a feat of athleticism at any age.
I'm Carl Peters, and I just came for this send-off and also doing the hill.
You're choosing to do the hill.
Yes, that's where I have come from. That's my challenge. I just turned 90, so that's my excuse.
No way!
Yes.
I catch up with the riders on the second day in Lake City, Minnesota, for what they call their brew-up. They unpack their tablecloths, elaborate tea sets, and a smorgasbord of food from their bike baskets for a picnic in the park. Charlotte Cowdery of Minneapolis was picnicking with her dad and fiancé.
We had a lot. We had smoked oysters. We had kind of a dual Japanese tea, English tea situation. So we had this bourbon smoked Earl Grey, which was phenomenal. But we also had matcha.
Straight matcha, Japanese matcha.
With little Japanese tea cakes. So, you know.
Notice that I haven't called any of this a race yet, because the picnic's the only part of this whole thing that's a competition. They give out awards for the best spread, and Noah Holzer says some people even bring solid silver English tea sets and fine china. So,
and who won the tea competition this year?
Great question. That was Russell, who ran it this year. He ended up bringing something that I haven't seen in a few years. I think he said he brought it last 5 years ago, because it's rather heavy, but a wind-up gramophone. And so he has made a special mount for it that sits on the back of his bike. And despite it being a bit heavy and having to carry 10-inch shellac records along with him, he manages his way around the lake with it.
That's hilarious.
But besides the brew-up, the Lake Pepin 3-Speed Tour has never been about winning. The whole point is to slow down, to take in the scenery, and enjoy life at a pace that's rare in the modern world. John Sherritt puts it best.
It's not always easy. It's never about being easy. It's a challenge, a physical challenge. But the other side of that coin is we got all day. I mean, the people, we got a couple that like their race off, be first to the finish line. But what are they going to do when they get there? They're going to just sit on the curb and wait for everybody else to show up. This type of touring is never about getting there first. It's the attitude of what we call a gentleman cyclist who realizes that it's not about getting there first. It's about the ride, not about the finish. So.
Personally, I don't see anything nuts about that. For Wisconsin Today, I'm Beatrice Lawrence.
That was Wisconsin Today producer Beatrice Lawrence on the 2026 Lake Pepin 3-Speed Bike Tour along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border. Special thanks to Technical Director Sarah Hopeful for sound editing and design.
Do you have a 3-Speed bike? What is the story behind it? And what do you love about riding an old bike, cycling as it used to be? Share your story at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. One awesome thing about our job is we're able to meet new people all over the state who are doing really cool things. We get to sample their art, their music, and other ways they make their corner of Wisconsin a little more special.
And now it's your turn. What place in Wisconsin should we pay a visit to and why? What person is doing a neat thing in your community that you want to highlight and recognize? Is there an event, we should check out and what makes it memorable.
I'm always up for a road trip, Rob. Send us a text. You can leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Weekend is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.